This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Climate change in many countries and communities is in practice undermining development. And therefore, we've got to put an emphasis on money and resources for prevention of the worst effects of these predictable weather shocks.
That's Mary Robinson, UN Special Envoy on El Niño and climate. Details coming up.
Also, following weeks of relative quiet, the Nigerian military says Boko Haram militants attacked two Borno State cities yesterday. And Gabon's President Ali Bongo is due to be sworn in tomorrow after the country's highest court validated his re-election last Friday.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Nigerian military says Boko Haram militants attacked two Borno State cities yesterday. Following weeks of relative quiet, militants launched a pre-dawn rocket-propelled grenade attack on Logomani, 110 kilometers north of the state capital of Maiduguri. Officials say 22 Boko Haram fighters and four Nigerian soldiers died in that clash. Late Sunday, militants exploded a landmine and ambushed a military convoy near Bama, 70 kilometers southeast of Maiduguri. Four soldiers and three insurgents died in the fight.
Gabon's President Ali Bongo is due to be sworn in tomorrow after the country's highest court validated his re-election last Friday. Opposition leader Jean Ping rejected the court's ruling and said he will not retreat. However, his next steps are unclear. Emily Iob has more from Abidjan.
President Ali Bongo has called for political dialogue after this month's contentious election. Opposition leader Jean Ping also claimed to have won the August 27 poll. He called the Constitutional Court's ruling on Friday a miscarriage of justice. But his options now are limited, says Paul Melly, West and Central Africa analyst at London-based Chatham House.
Jean Ping is probably realistic. He knows that in the normal constitutional process, it is highly unlikely that there's any possibility of the election result being reversed. So I think what Jean Ping is trying to do is maintain the political pressure on Ali Bongo.
Ping is a former ally of Bongo's father, who ruled the country for over four decades until his death in 2009. Deadly violence erupted in Libreville earlier this month after the Electoral Commission announced that Bongo had beaten Ping by a margin of just under 6,000 votes. France joined Ping in calling for a recount of the ballots in disputed areas. The United States called for the release of results by polling stations. The government refused. The European Union continues to express concern about the fairness of the poll. Analysts say Bongo has also faced pressure at home, with several members of the ruling party defecting even before the vote.
He had, in his first term, tried to position himself as a reformer, and he'd made some progress with that. But it was patchy. It may be that now the combination of international pressure and domestic political pressure will force him to make wider concessions. For example, we could imagine that in municipal elections or parliamentary elections, he might have to cede a genuinely transparent and really credible election process for those type of votes.
Analyst Gilles Yabi, founder of the West African think tank WATI, says electoral reform could very well be on the table during the proposed political dialogue. Yabi says that we could imagine that at some point a deep reform of the Gabonese electoral system will have to be discussed, including the lack of presidential term limits and the current practice of a single-round election. He says reform will be needed to open the way for change in leadership through credible and transparent election results. Ping has not said whether he will answer Bongo's invitation for political dialogue. Emily Yab for VOA News in Abidjan.
The government of Sudan says it will not serve as a launching pad for a declaration of armed resistance by Sudan's former vice president, Riek Machar. The Sudan News Agency reports that Foreign Minister Ibrahim Gandour made the statement after Machar met with supporters on September 23rd in Khartoum. Machar called for armed resistance to the South Sudan government of President Salva Kiir. Machar fled from South Sudan following clashes in July between his forces and those of President Kiir. After gaining independence 5 years ago, South Sudan has suffered nearly 3 years of armed conflict. The two sides have been unable to abide by a treaty signed in August of last year.
Italy says it's running out of money to take care of the migrants in flowing into the country. Aid organizations have warned the Interior Ministry that hundreds of millions of dollars are needed to prevent the system from collapsing. Reporter Josephine McKenna is covering developments in Italy on the migrant crisis. From Rome, she provided me with an update and told me about her recent visit to a migrant camp on the French border where migrants expressed frustration with their situation.
Well, organizations have warned the government that an additional 600 million euros is needed to prevent the system from collapsing. There's great pressure to try and get more money out of the Ministry of Finance here from the Treasury to try and keep these centers going. As we know, there are several hundred centers across the country that are hosting migrants. We have around 160,000 in different locations across the country. We've had 130,000 arrivals this year. On top of the number of adults that are being hosted, there are also around 10,000 unaccompanied minors in these centres across Italy. And many of them are providing 3 meals a day. They're providing beds for the night. I spoke to one centre today in Ventimiglia, where I visited just a couple of weeks ago, and they had around 600 stay overnight and around 700 people lining up for meals there today. That one's run by the Red Cross. So that gives you an idea of the numbers of people that are depending on these centres for their survival.
You mentioned that you visited the Ventimiglia camp. So can you tell us what is the position of the migrants at this point? What are they saying?
Well, it's a very depressing situation. As you can imagine, many of the migrants have travelled across the Mediterranean. They've made very dangerous journeys by sea. The ones at this particular camp, mostly from Sudan, Eritrea and Ethiopia, they've been blocked there at the border. Some of them have even crossed into France. They are all focused on trying to get to other countries elsewhere in Europe. Many have been sent back 2 or 3 times from France back into Italy because they don't have legal documents. And they're talking about that frustration of just being in a no-man's land, not wanting to stay in Italy, but not having any kind of work or education or structure. Many of them are focused on Germany, Scandinavia, and the UK and France, and they really don't want to stay in Italy. But they're living in really basic conditions, and in this particular camp, there's around 700 men in that area. And I visited another camp inside a church where mostly women and families were being housed. So a very depressing situation for many of these people who are trying to build a future and still look very traumatized by their trip across the Mediterranean.
I understand that Prime Minister Renzi, he is setting up a task force on migration. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, this is part of the Italian government's frustration with the situation and feeling that it's not being managed effectively. Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has talked about setting up a task force to work with the individual government ministries and the European Union to try and create a system that functions more effectively, that shares the load, the incoming number of migrants with other countries in the EU, and also to speed up the repatriation of migrants whom they feel do not deserve to stay in Europe. That involves negotiations with countries like Nigeria, Mali, Ethiopia, and Senegal.
Also, I see there's a new poll that shows that 83% of Italian nationals want more border control. So this is in light of the migrants wanting to move around in Europe.
That's right. We're seeing a growing tide of opposition, concern about the numbers of migrants who are increasing against a backdrop of inadequate job availability, not enough jobs here for Italian nationals already. And so that pressure in the job market making it so much more demanding when they see the numbers of migrants arriving here. With elections on the horizon in Germany and France, that pressure is likely to continue. We're seeing also that immigration is the top concern for voters, even ahead of terrorism and unemployment. And that was also seen at the weekend when Switzerland's Italian-speaking canton, Ticino, voted in favour of limiting access to workers coming across the border. Around 60,000 Italians cross into that region for work as commuters. It's interesting to see that the Swiss are tightening up that border arrangement and making it more difficult for people to cross that border area there.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Italy.
Although the El Niño weather event may have peaked last May, the UN says its devastating impact continues. It warns El Niño is having long-term consequences for public health, nutrition, livelihoods, water, and sanitation. Former Irish President Mary Robinson is a UN Special Envoy on El Niño and climate. From New York, she told VOA's Jody Capua that the problem should be addressed as a climate justice issue.
El Niño is a normal weather pattern that countries have been used to, and it has brought flooding and drought to those countries over the decades and, you know, hundreds of years. And it's predictable. That's the important thing. It comes every 3 to 7 years. But it's now warming on warmer water off Peru, and it's stronger and hitting countries in a way they've never been hit before. And these countries, these communities are already affected by climate change. It brings out what I feel very strongly, the injustice of how climate change is impacting the poorest countries and communities disproportionately. And these are the countries that are affected by El Niño. I've been to Ethiopia in June. I was in Honduras because there's a dry corridor in Central America where countries are very affected. I was in Southern Africa, in Swaziland, and talking to the leaders of Southern Africa who were gathered there because that's the most affected place at the end of August. And I was in Vietnam in early September, earlier this month. All of these places have been affected, and none of them have been primarily responsible for the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing this worsening effect through climate.
Now, you talk about climate justice. How would you like to see climate justice handed out in this case?
I think we can do it very clearly in a developmental way. We can bring access to clean energy to the 1.3 billion people who don't ever switch on a switch of electricity, who have kerosene and candles and pay too much for them. We need to reach them with clean energy. We need to help developing countries in general to build their infrastructure with clean energy, to leapfrog into solar and wind and biomass and geothermal, etc. Because otherwise, if they go into dirty fossil fuel energy, then the problems will get worse and they will be worst affected.
When you visited countries in Africa, for example, what were the most obvious signs of the effects of El Niño and climate change?
Terrible drought, appalling drought for 2 years, the loss of 2 years of harvest. And of course, it affects women disproportionately because they have to try to be the ones who put the food on the table, who go further for water because of water stress. And I also see that in communities, women are very significant in trying to build resilience. That perhaps brings me to the thinking that we can't afford in 3 to 7 years' time to have another heavy El Niño hit these same countries and these same communities. We've got to make them more resilient. So we've decided to have a blueprint for action starting in March 2017, getting the UN to work better together across all the different agencies. You know, this isn't just a humanitarian issue. It's, in fact, if it becomes more humanitarian, we have failed. So it's also development, it's climate smart agriculture, it's disaster risk reduction and insurance, it's food security, it's gender. And we have to get all the agencies in, not just the UN, but in the EU, the African Union, etc., to work better together. We also need the private sector and civil society. And funnily enough, this fits in a new push by the Secretary General for Resilience. He launched during the past week, and I was there, a whole global approach to emphasizing making communities more resilient, more able to cope.
Why do we need this if we have the new Sustainable Development Goals?
Well, it's actually part of the new Sustainable Goals. They fit into this. We've got to be better at making communities able to withstand further shocks of drought, further shocks of intense flooding, and further heavy cyclones and hurricanes to the countries most affected, and small island states in particular. It can wipe out their whole development. So as we move to the Sustainable Development Goals, climate change in many countries and communities is in practice undermining development. And therefore, we've got to put an emphasis on money and resources for prevention of the worst effects of these predictable weather shocks. So we have time to plan for building in more resilience. I've seen communities seek to become more resilient. I saw it in Tigray in northern Ethiopia. We were going through a bleak, scorched earth part of Tigray, and suddenly a green area. How come? Because they were managing their water. They were damming the river to make sure the water was held. They were planting trees and growing crops within trees in a very climate-smart agriculture way, and it made all the difference. So, you know, communities can withstand these shocks if they are helped to become resilient.
President Mary Robinson is a UN Special Envoy on El Niño and climate from New York. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Following weeks of relative quiet, the Nigerian military says Boko Haram militants attacked two Borno state cities yesterday. Gabon's President Ali Bongo is due to be sworn in tomorrow after the country's highest court validated his re-election last Friday. And Italy says it's running out of money to take care of the continuous flow of migrants into the country. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is sharply criticizing a protest leader calling Pastor Evan Mawariri a disgrace. He says the founder of the hashtag This Flag movement is being used by Western powers to criticize his government. Mawariri is in self-imposed exile in the United States. Upon returning to Zimbabwe after attending the UN General Assembly last week, Mr. Mugabe described him as a great shame.
Last week, heads of state, government ministers, ambassadors, national delegations, and NGO leaders descended on New York for the opening of the UN General Assembly. Among those attending was Linda Thomas-Greenfield, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She reflected on the week's highlight in this exclusive interview with VOA's Adam Phillips.
It's been extraordinarily busy. I'm exhausted after a full week of bilateral meetings with every head of state or delegation that I could possibly meet with. I met with some who just wanted to meet with me and have a courtesy call, and I met with others where we had to discuss intense issues of concern, and those issues are what is happening in Gabon. Right now, we expect that a decision might have been made today by the Constitutional Court on the disputed election. We had meetings on South Sudan and a serious expression of disappointment that South Sudan is where it is today, and a frustration that we have not been able to find a path for peace in South Sudan, but a dedication to doing that.
And did you feel heard in that disappointment? I mean, do you think it's going to be a substantive righting of the course because it came through?
Absolutely. The UN had a special session on South Sudan, and that expression of frustration was, I think, indicated. But also there was a commitment.
What about Burundi? I mean, there's been a lot of rumbling about that of late. I was wondering what you had to say about that.
We still have some more work to do on Burundi. There is a dialogue process that is being led by the former president of Tanzania, President Mkapa. We thought that he has put some new life into the discussions in Burundi, and we're hopeful that these discussions will lead to a process that will bring peace back to this country. For 10 years, Burundi had peace. And a decision by President Nkurunziza to extend for a third term has lost all of the accomplishments that he made over 10 years and set this country back.
So you think the blush is off the rose?
Oh, the blush is off the rose. It really is. And the people who are suffering the most are ordinary people. You know, I tell the people who work in the Africa Bureau, and they're all extraordinarily dedicated to Africa, that they should know that that's what our job is. We deal with governments so that we can bring a better life to the people of Africa.
Tell me about the DRC now. We're sort of switching to that area of the world. What's the same and what's different about the situation? What's the scenario look like from your seat?
We're very worried about the situation in DRC. The recent breakdown of the dialogue has disappointed all of us. We're hopeful that the dialogue or some new dialogue will start up that will be inclusive, that will find a way forward for there to be a transition. And again, I think that President Kabila, if he allows for a transition, will go down in history. He will leave a legacy for his country as the first elected president to leave office and turn over power to a newly elected president.
And if he doesn't, he'll have another legacy.
If he doesn't, he'll have another legacy, which is one in which his country may be even more difficult to govern, and that his population is not able to benefit from the immense resources that this country can provide.
So what's good that's going on in Africa?
I love that question. There is so much good that is happening on the continent of Africa. As we look at the election in Nigeria and Senegal and Benin and Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, I can go on and on. And I know I'm leaving out countries that will be listening and say, well, why didn't she mention our country? But there's too many to mention. And I think that's the positive thing. And then we see an extraordinary cohort of young people in Africa who want to contribute to the continent's future, and they are that future.
That was Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips at the United Nations in New York. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Keith Holmes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
The political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, a conversation with Arthur Opio Oloya about his book, Black Hawks Rising, the story of AMISOM's successful war against Somali insurgency. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.